Well, I've already said good morning to you, and again, it's just a joy to be here, and I thank Alistair for inviting me to come. I'm very sorry that those who didn't get to the weekend, I hope you'll not be too disappointed in missing the speaker. I met the speaker, Roy Searle, once before when I was down at Northumbria for a retreat, and if anybody's looking for a lovely place to go for a spiritual retreat, that is, I would certainly recommend it. And it's a lovely place and people. I want to read from Hebrews 5, 1 to 10. Every high priest is selected from among men and is appointed to represent them in matters relating to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since He himself is subject to weakness. That is why he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins, as well as for the sins of the people. No one takes this honor upon himself. He must be called by God just as Aaron was. So Christ also did not take upon himself the glory of becoming a high priest. But God said to him, "You are my son. Today I have become your father." And he says in another place, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." And then we have a description of Jesus' life. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek. And chapter 7 and verse 25, "Therefore he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them." So do I have a screen to see? Is it on? Ah. So the subject is, it'll come up in a moment. How would you define distraction? I don't know if you have many distractions in life. Well, the Collins Dictionary puts it like this. It's a distraction is something. Oh, I see. Ah, here it is. It's so obvious I can't see it. A distraction is something that turns your attention away from something you want to concentrate on. Or it can be an activity which is intended to entertain and amuse you. Those are the definitions which I looked at and considered to be appropriate. Now, the subject suggested by Alistair was to link in with the weekend people who were away. And the title was The Praying Life, Connecting with God in a Distracting World. And so I want to give you a few illustrations to start with. Here is a minister, and he is somewhat distracted by his congregation. He says, mine is a giving church. And that's a really good note to start with for a minister, isn't it? Mine is a giving church. They give me advice. They give me ulcers. And they give me ultimatums. Now, I guess you won't get many of those in Scotland. And the reason is, we're not used to such generous givers in Scotland. And what about the parishioner with a very wide vision? And here he is. And if you look even at the back, the scoreboard at the back of the attendance, you'll see that this is the average congregation. And so there is the pastor trying to talk to them. And Errol thinks that they should become a mega church. And the minister says to him, "Would you elaborate on that, please?" Now, I looked at that and I thought, well, there's somebody totally distracted from the everyday pressures of that church, going there every week to worship with one other person. He shouldn't have been concerned about a mega church. He could have been concerned about, you know, even getting up to the 12 disciples would have been a real boost and a real growth. So distractions. And something which is possible in churches where I am invited to preach. Here's a man being interviewed for a job. Your computer skills are lacking, but it would be great to hire someone who can't make a PowerPoint. Now, the reason I like that one is because I think the CCC audiovisual team wish I was that interviewee, because the PowerPoints I use are somewhat distracting and somewhat different from everybody else's. Instead of bullet points, because of the depth, I like to use it fuller PowerPoints. So what distractions, I want to ask this morning, did Jesus face? I always think the best place to go for any example is Jesus. It's quite interesting, isn't it, when you at a communion service, more often than not in many churches, not in all, you'll hear the communion reading from Corinthians, from Paul. And in many churches, seldom does the communion reading of the institution of the Lord's Supper come from the words of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And I always feel Jesus is sometimes neglected in favor of Paul. And I find that very strange. And I know it doesn't happen in churches like yours here in Kilduffel, but it certainly does happen. So I think everything we do, we should look at Jesus and keep our focus and attention on Him and learn from Him. And so this morning, I want to look at some distractions that Jesus faced, because I think we'll be able to identify with them in our individual lives. And the first thing I have here is remembering His humanity. Physical exhaustion was a distraction which could have been very huge in the life of Jesus. And let's not forget that Jesus was not only God, He was man, the God-man. And so let's not forget that human element, because it means He's able to understand us and the pressures we experience. He knows all about it because He's been there in His humanity. I want you to watch one day in the life of Jesus. Mark chapter 1, His teaching ended. He was going up, He was speaking, He was teaching, and a man who was possessed with an evil spirit interrupted the service. And then Jesus was asked to bring healing, and He did. He left the synagogue and He went to stay with Peter, and Peter's mom-in-law was there, and she was ill, and Jesus healed her. And at the door later that evening, the news had spread of what had happened in the synagogue, of what had happened in Peter's home, and suddenly the whole village was there, congregating, bringing along all the sick. And we're told that He healed many with various diseases. Now, I want you to recall with me His humanity here and His spiritual sensitivity. Because when Jesus was on His way to Jairus' home to bring healing to his daughter, you remember an elderly lady who had suffered hemorrhaging for over 12 years and had spent all her money in doctors, came to Jesus in a crowd and touched Him. And Jesus turned and said, "Who touched me?" And the disciples said to Him, "Listen, are you mad? Look around you. There's people, scores of people touching you." He said, "No, somebody touched me." And the reason was He felt power going out of Him into the life of the person who touched Him. Now, let's not forget that. When you think of that day that Jesus had just come through, starting in the synagogue, preaching and teaching, and then He delivering this man from the evil spirit, then healing Peter's mom-in-law, and then the sick of the town. Think of the energy that must have been drained out of the life of Jesus, because everyone He touched, if it was the same experience as that lady, it would have been a drain constantly as power went out of Him to heal the lives of people. So that at the end of that day, I suggest to you, Jesus would have been exhausted in every way that you could imagine, emotionally, spiritually, and physically, exhausted. And I'm sure He would have been delighted to get into His bed. But look at what we read next. In Mark 1, 35 to 37, Jesus got up to pray when? He didn't say, wow, what a day that was. I think I'll have a lie in. Not at all. There wasn't that thought that entered his mind. Instead, he gave thanks to God, obviously, for the day that had passed. But he said, my next day is going to be the same, so I need to have that spiritual energy renewed in the presence of God and from God himself. And so very early in the morning, Jesus got up out of his bed, and when the disciples awakened, he is gone. And they went looking for him. Where have you gone? Where have you been? He had sneaked out because he wanted to spend time alone with God. And then he said, I needed to be here. And I needed to be in the presence of God to plan. And he said, now we're going to move on to the nearby villages. So what do we learn from Jesus? He overcame his tiredness through prayer. So here was a distraction. Physical exhaustion could have distracted him. He could have easily laid on in bed with the disciples and said, no, his mission was too important. What about us at the end of a busy day? Would you not agree with that? One decision in relation to our devotional lives is often tiredness, it distracts us. But we still leave our devotions until the very end of the day when we know we're going to be exhausted. And we get into our beds and we feel comfy, we pull the duvet up and we get our Bibles, and the next thing we know, we're off. Do you not think Jesus deserves better? I wonder how much time you and I spend in our devotions. And when do we give him that time? I've done a lot of thinking over this sermon. It was a very difficult sermon for me. Because some of the things we're talking about, they've been in my life as real problems. And this is one. And I remember the Billy Graham organization many, many years ago. It was in the 70s when I was in Dalkeith. And there was a survey done. And out of that survey came the amazing news that ministers spent an average of 2 to 3 minutes in prayer per day. That has never left my head since the 1970s. And the reason why we don't pray very much, it varies. Work and family, church and fitness, watching box sets, hobby, reading, games. And at the end of all of that, plus our day's work, and whatever else you want to add to that list, we make our way up the stairs and we say, now it's time to talk to God. And the next thing, we're away. Jesus didn't allow that to distract him. Tiredness. He knew that if his life was to tell for his Father, he needed renewed spiritually. And he didn't allow sleep and physical exhaustion to become a distraction. I just felt myself thinking, what would he have done? He knew the scriptures in a phenomenal way, and he could have read and reflected and meditated on words like that. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. And my dear friends, that's what God promises us. If we make him the priority and we meet with him in our prayer times, our strength will be renewed and we'll be able to go out and serve him. That little picture there shows we're plugging into God and God fills us with his Spirit. And this also applies to the church. That refers to A.T. Pearson, who was an amazing man of God. And I just conclude this point with this. God has no greater controversy with his people today than this. that with boundless promises to believing prayer, and I've only quoted one in the Bible, ask and you shall receive, knock, seek, all relating to prayer. There are so few who actually give themselves to intercession. The other evening, I put my hand in the little cabinet beside my bed, and the first thing I saw was a little red booklet, and it was Margaret's prayer guide. And I brought it out, and I read it, and it was the most moving thing as I ended that day. She had a section for Monday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. The names of all her family, and remember, she was one of 10 children, and all of those 10 children had children, one of them having 7. Every child named on the prayer list, and then folks in the church and other things. And then in the back of her Bible, all the years that she had read the Bible through in a year. It was the most humbling but blessed experience at the end of a day to remember Margaret as she was. And I wonder this morning, what about us? How do we fare in the sight of God in relation to our devotional life with God? Are we distracted from it? The second thing is, and the rest of it I'm just going to fly through, but that first point to me is the key to almost anything else I'll say. We as Christians need to get ourselves right with God devotionally. And we need to write all the things down that stop that happening. And we need to cut them off when needs be so that we become the people that God wants us to be. Second thing is, he could have been distracted here. It's always difficult choosing church leaders, isn't it? Always difficult. The reason being that we know that some will be chosen and some won't. And that's always hard. Jesus did the wisest thing. He prayed. We're told in Luke's gospel it was time to choose the 12 disciples. And what did he do? He didn't sit down and think, now there's about 100 people here. I wonder which ones are the best. Which ones would suit best? No. He's distinctly told that it came to the end of the day and he went up to a mountain to pray. And you can imagine from other experiences when he sees the disciples in the lake in the middle of the night, that prayer time for Jesus, remembering that he was a human being like us, that prayer time must have been exhausting. But he came down from the mountaintop and he then chose his 12. And I tell you, it tells us in Luke 6, he called them by name and set them apart. In Mark chapter 3, we're told that Jesus called them, first of all, to be with him, and secondly, to send them out to preach. That's his plan. Now, number one meant the 12 got to know Jesus. The 12 got to know Jesus. Do we know him? You know, Paul was an elderly guy when he wrote these words, my overriding desire is to know him. Not about him, but to know him. A deep, intimate, personal relationship. And Jesus wants that. And then, to me, this is grounds for, when I went to go into the Bible school, the Baptist college, my mother and my aunt objected. They lived in Northern Ireland, and my aunt was a very enthusiastic Baptist. My mum was a Presbyterian. But they disagreed because they thought, you're a Christian, and Jesus will train you, and Jesus will teach you. You don't need to go to college. And I remember taking this verse and pointing it out to them, because they said also, the disciples didn't go to college. And I said, but hold on. Who did he spend 3 years with? He was the greatest theologian, the greatest church historian, the greatest, you name it. And they spent time with him, being trained so that when he would leave, they could carry on the work. To avoid major distractions, should pray for elections. I sat in the study and looked back on all the years in the churches, and I thought of how much preparation went into planning how elections for deacons should take place, etc. And I thought, how much time did we set apart as a church to pray for guidance? But you know, even Jesus can't guarantee that there won't be problems. Remember his plan, I will build my church. But he was distracted by power struggles. Now, you can look all these up when you get home, if you wish. And Mark and Luke, you tell us of situations where the disciples were arguing among themselves as to who was to be greatest, who was to be the lead deacon or the lead elder. And so there were these power struggles going on. And at times, a mom even got involved when James and John's mother came and said, well, my son's not get position one and position two. Now, Jesus was building a successful church. And a church needs unity and diversity. So how did this not distract him? He prayed. He prayed and he mediated between them. He spent time talking with them, teaching them. Arrogance is wrong. And in Mark 9, you have all these references which just follow on from the ones above, where Jesus spent time working with them and teaching them. But my dear friends, sad to say, power struggles, people problems will always be distractions in a church. I don't know any church that hasn't got people problems and power struggles. It shouldn't be. It's not the way of Jesus. And the only way to avoid it is to spend time in prayer. Prayer should be our priority. Jesus overcame the worst possible distraction. And this is, I approach this with nervousness in case some people will think, But it tells us in the Bible that he who knew no sin became sin for us. And if ever there was a problem for Jesus, it was this one. And this is where I'm a little nervous. People may think I'm stretching it a bit. The distraction was pleasing himself or pleasing his Father. Now, how does that come out? Do you remember his prayer in Gethsemane? What he prayed was this, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will. Now, notice those. I never had looked at those words before. Not as I will. What was he saying? You know, if I was just being honest and putting my cards on the table here, the thought of being made sin, me, the holy God, being made sin, is too horrendous for me to bear. I want to pass on this one. So often we focus on the physical pain. But Jesus was concentrating on the spiritual pain that the spotless Son of God took upon himself, our sin. He became sin for us. And when his Father looked at him, he didn't see his son. He saw this bundle of sin, yours, mine, everyone in the world laid on his son. How dreadful that must have been for Jesus. But that is suggesting to me he had a choice. Pleasing himself. If you do what I will at this moment, the world will be lost eternally. And despite that horror, he rose from his knees and saying, I'll become sin. I'll allow myself to be contaminated in the worst possible way because the world needs salvation. What a Savior. He did it out of love for the 12 and us. And my dear friends, discipleship hasn't changed. Discipleship is summed up in these words, not as I will, but as you will. Has God ever asked you to do something, to visit someone, to speak to someone, to take something to someone, to leave your job and go into full-time ministry, and you've been able to rhyme off all the reasons why none of them would work? When that happens, we should go into Gethsemane. And we should listen to the words of Jesus. Not as I will, but your will be done. I wonder, will we make a commitment to the Father as Jesus did? The last possible distraction I have here is the problem of pain and suffering. You all know that this problem of pain and suffering can create many questions. It can bring upset, it can bring anger, it can bring sadness. It's almost 3 years since Margaret went home to be with Jesus. And I still have the pain, as I did when she died. Pain and suffering poses questions. It's not that you question the fact of dying. It's the reality. We all have to face it. But why did it happen as it did? How did Jesus deal with it? Because he was confronted with it all the time. In Matthew 26, he struggles. Listen to what he cries out on the cross. Because he was made sin, my God, why have you forsaken me? That intimacy that he had always enjoyed from eternity was gone, he felt. He felt in himself. That was his feeling. He was under that tremendous spiritual pressure. But look at what happens. After a short period, he had made a transition in his mind. And the transition led to him praying, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." Can you see the contrast? Why have you forsaken me? And hanging there on the cross, it came home to him. I made this decision voluntarily for the world. I have to do this to save the world. Father, Father, even though I didn't want to come through this, I'm glad. And I now give myself fully into your care and keeping. That was an amazing example of trusting and trial. I wonder if any of you read The Shack. I realize this is possibly one of the most controversial books for evangelicals. Evangelicals like us here this morning will lift this book and we will look at it and we'll put it aside and we would never recommend it. I'm the complete opposite. I have read this twice. I've watched the DVD twice. And I do commend it. There are things in my mind that poses problems. I mean, if you've seen the film or if you've read the book, God comes, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, to this man. A man who had been brutally abused as he was growing up. and who then married happily and lost his little girl when he was away saving his son and daughter from drowning on a weekend away, just him and the three children. And his little girl was taken away by a well-known child abuser. And she was never found. And then something happens, and I can't go into the whole story, but he finds himself back at a shack. And God's there, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And they talk. And at one point in the conversation, he asks God, "Did Missy have to die so you could change me?" Now, this to me is at the very heart of the theology of this book. Did Missy have to die so you could change me? And here's the answer. "Whoa there, Mac," God leaned forward. "That's not how I do things. Just because I work incredible good out of unspeakable tragedies." Now, notice that, because God does do that. Doesn't mean I orchestrate the tragedies. And that's where we as Christians go wrong at times. We think God has orchestrated the tragedies, and look at what he's done. But no, God doesn't orchestrate the tragedies. But when they happen, when we trust and obey as Jesus did on the cross, God can bring amazing good out of that experience. And God went on, "Don't ever assume my using something means I caused or needed it to accomplish my purposes. That will only lead to false notions about me. Grace doesn't depend on suffering to exist. But where there is suffering, you will find grace in many facets and colors. My purposes are not for my comfort or yours. My purposes are always and only an expression of love. I purpose to bring life out of death, freedom out of brokenness, turn darkness into light." God saying, all these tragedies which happened without me planning them, I'm changing them. And I have the potential to revolutionize the situations. All things must unfold, even though it puts all those I love in the midst of a world of horrible tragedies, even the one closest to me. And Max says, "You're talking about Jesus, aren't you?" "Everything's about him," God says. "Everything's about him. And one day you folk will understand all he gave." There are no words. I wonder this morning, are we willing to trust and not be distracted by pain and suffering? And with this I finish. He went home to do more work. He didn't even get the chance to lie back and put his feet up at retirement, because the title was The Praying Life, Jesus' Praying Life. Why does Jesus need to continue praying? Now he lives forever to pray to God on our behalf. Why does he need to continue praying? Because we sin. Am I the only one who would put his hand up this morning and say, "Dear God, since I met to worship you last Sunday, I haven't sinned. I have sinned." That's why Jesus continues praying. Because we sin in thought, in word, in deed. And he's gracious. Jesus grants it. My dear friends, individually, corporately, there's so many things that can distract us. But we find the answer to them all in Jesus. He is our example. He prayed for physical energy. "Don't let my tiredness distract me. Don't let the pointing of leaders cause disruption." Power struggles, they wear me out. They are so demanding. How foolish. pleasing self. No, pleasing the Father. He faced suffering, and he still prays for us. I love this old hymn. In every pain that tears the heart, the man of sorrows had a part. He sympathizes with our grief, and to the sufferer sends relief. That's the promise of Jesus today. Whatever problem we're facing at the minute, no matter how big or how great or huge, whatever way we want to describe it, it is, Jesus said, look, I've been there. I've gone through all these things that you're going through at the moment. I've been there. I've touched them. I've been there tangibly in the midst of them. Out of my strength, I want to help you overcome them. My closing hope is that we will pray continually and stop running away from meeting with God in prayer and start running towards Him and giving Him the time and the devotion that He wants. And as we give ourselves to Him, He will undoubtedly give Himself to us. Our closing hymn reminds us